God's forgiveness is freely offered us. See the parable. But gratitude is a learned trait that requires us to get outside ourselves. Gratitude requires recognition of another's grace-filled offering, of another's doing something for us, and our accepting the gift with humility.
That's the Reverend Dr. Fairfax Fair, and today she brings you an inspiring message entitled, Choosing to be Captive or Free. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're honored to welcome the Reverend Dr. Fairfax F. Fair, Senior Pastor of First Presbyterian Church of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Fairfax earned her bachelor's degree from Southern Methodist University in Dallas and a Master of Divinity degree from Union Presbyterian Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, on whose board of trustees she serves. She earned her Doctor of Ministry degree from Columbia Theological Seminary in Decatur, Georgia. Before coming to First Presbyterian in Ann Arbor, she served as senior pastor of Highland Presbyterian Church in Louisville, Kentucky. She's also served as pastor and associate pastor at churches in Texas and Tennessee. Fairfax, welcome to Day One.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, Peter.
You're a native of Arkansas and spent much of your life in southern states, but now you've served as senior pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Ann Arbor for 6.5 years, 7 winters, as you put it. How has your acclimation gone?
It's been a real joy to be in Ann Arbor. The people there are warm, even though the climate is cold, and there are people there from all over the world, and so it's a fascinating place to serve.
What has you most excited about the church you serve, its people and its ministries?
The people are bright, they are engaged, they are committed to their church, they care deeply about one another, they want to get along, they want to challenge themselves to think about important issues and respond in ways that are appropriate and faithful. One of the exciting things that we have at First Pres is a resident ministry program where we bring in young pastors for their first ministry experience. They come and serve with us for 2 years immediately after graduating from seminary. We embed them in the life of the church. They have wonderful experiences. So when they leave us, they go out very well equipped to serve in other places across the country.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the community surrounding First Presbyterian? I know the university is nearby.
We are virtually on campus.
Oh.
The church began in 1826. That's before Michigan became a state.
Hmm.
We moved to our present location in 1937. At that point, that area was called the Grove. Now it is surrounded by university buildings. We have throngs of college students who walk through our building every day on their way to and from classes.
Hmm.
So it's a wonderful, vibrant community. I love the fact that every fall you get this fresh infusion of energy with the new students and new faculty and staff coming to town.
Hmm.
So it's a very vibrant place to serve.
Your church had an interesting project this summer, a series of 4 different walks commemorating times in history when God's people either chose or were forced to walk. Tell us about that and why you did it.
There were really 2 things that motivated our doing these walks this summer. One was we wanted to take the idea of the flat Jesus and give the children in the congregation the opportunity to color Jesus and let Jesus go with them on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And then we thought about teaming Jesus going with us on vacation with how Jesus walks with us through all our different parts of life. And we decided to pair it with our summer theme, which comes from Micah, to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. And think about the fact that there are over 65 million displaced people in our world today. And to lift up our concern for them. And so we chose to do that through historic walks. And these walks vary from very short to very long. And we are encouraging individuals in the congregation to team with others in the congregation and pool their miles and to think as they do these walks about Jesus walking with them and how Jesus' heart would break for some of the situations that we have encountered historically and sadly continue to encounter today.
You've served four other churches as associate pastor or senior pastor, and in each case, you were the first woman to serve in that role. That's certainly becoming more common, but how have you handled this cultural and denominational change?
In every one of these settings, I felt that I answered God's call. Mm-hmm. I never set out to prove something. And there's been resistance, and it's taken different forms, but I've also been very blessed in each one of the settings where I've served to know that God has indeed called me to that place, and God has given me the privilege of working with wonderful people.
You not only write for magazines and journals, but you're an avid reader as well, and I understand you've focused recently on 20th century civil rights history as well as World War II. What has drawn you to those subjects?
In the summer of 2016, I was blessed to be able to take a sabbatical.
Mm-hmm.
And my focus of that sabbatical was pastors who had spoken on God's side during particularly 1960 to 1965 around the civil rights issues throughout this country. And I had the opportunity to go and talk with 20 some odd ministers of different denominations across the country who had very powerful experiences during those days. And so as a part of that, leading up to that work and following up on that work, I've read a great deal about the civil rights struggle in this country and had the opportunity to visit many sites across the country. And it's also sort of broadened into also an interest in the way the Japanese were treated and the internment camps that they suffered through in World War II.
Fairfax, how did you experience your calling to the ministry?
I never thought I would become a pastor. For little girls growing up in South Arkansas, that was not an option. But as I look back in retrospect, I can see even as a teenager that God was calling me. I could not have named it because it was not a possibility. I had never met a woman in ministry in any denomination. But I came to feel very strongly that God was indeed calling me to ministry. I considered a number of other options. I considered going to law school. I considered going to medical school. My father wanted me to go to business school. But I knew that God was calling me, and God was not going to take no for an answer. So I entered Union Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, and immediately felt that that was where God was calling me to be. And from the beginning, I have felt deeply called to parish ministry. That's where my heart is. It's such a joy and privilege to get to interact with the faithful across the country, to be privileged to walk with them through good days and bad. And it's a great joy.
Well, today your sermon focuses on the gospel lesson for this Sunday from Matthew chapter 18. Would you read it for us?
Sure, Peter. Be happy to. Peter came and said to Jesus, "Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? As many as seven times?" Jesus said to him, "Not seven times, but 77 times." The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. When he began the reckoning, one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. And as he could not pay, his Lord ordered him to be sold, together with his wife and children and all his possessions, and payment to be made. So the slave fell on his knees before him, saying, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you everything." Out of pity for him, the Lord released him and forgave him the debt. But that same slave, as he went out, came upon one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii. Seizing him by the throat, he said, "Pay what you owe." Then his fellow slave fell down and pleaded with him, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you." But he refused. He went and threw him into prison. When his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed. They went and reported to their lord all that had taken place. Then his lord summoned him and said, "You wicked slave! I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you?" In anger, his lord handed him over to be tortured until he would pay his entire debt. So my Heavenly Father will also do to every one of you, if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart.
Clearly, forgiveness and mercy are very important to Jesus. What struck you as you approached this text?
The immediate thing that came to me as I was reading this text and beginning to study this text and prepare this sermon was God's amazing generosity toward us and how stingy we are in showing that same generosity to others.
Fairfax, we look forward to learning more about this in your sermon, Choosing to be Captive or Free. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. The phone call came out of the blue. The men on the call, men whose son and daughter were married to one another, were cordial, but not buddies, not pals. They lived in different towns. They led separate lives. If not for their young adult children, they never would have known one another. Jack initiated the call. His son was still just a boy. Yes, he was married. True, he could buy a beer, vote, and legally sign a contract. But he really was still just a boy, still growing up, still maturing, still growing into the man he would become. Or not. Or not because Jack's boy, his son, had metastatic cancer. The boy, the young man, wanted to live. Oh, how badly he wanted to live for his wife, for their newly born child, for the hopes he had, for a house that someday would be full of children, for a house that would be a gathering place for his children's friends and neighborhood kids. But none of that was apt to happen. Jack's son was dying. Jack initiated the call that late afternoon. He was angry, very angry, because his son had spurned his advice. Thunderstorms had crisscrossed the area the day before, the day Jack Jr. was to return to the hospital. The boy, the young man, had elected for the couple and their son to drive back to the city instead of flying in Jack's light plane. The decision infuriated his father. The girl's father listened. Jack was unrelenting. He wanted the two of them, the two fathers, to confront their children together, to tell them how wrong their action was. The rant stretched on. "Jack," the other man finally said, "stop. Think how lucky you are to have your son. When you go down tomorrow for his birthday, don't fuss at your boy. Celebrate that he is alive to turn 25. Love him." But Jack persisted. His anger ran unabated. The other father kept trying. "Be grateful you have him. This may be the last birthday you get with him." The next day, Jack and his wife visited their son in the hospital. Double IVs ran into his chest and his arm, carrying chemo and hydrating fluids. His parents told him how angry they were. They blasted him for making the decision to drive instead of fly. Then they left. The young man's birthday was not mentioned. Jesus tells a parable about a king who does some checking on his accounts receivable and discovers that a certain laborer owes him about a gazillion dollars, more than the combined national economies of all the G8 nations. The laborer is summoned. He falls to his knees and begs for mercy, for time to do the impossible, for time to repay what is owed. Inexplicably and without so much as a word, the king relents. The king as much as shrugs and says, "Okay, I forgive the debt." And just like that, the laborer is free. His totally unpayable debt is vaporized, whoosh, like the sound of thousands of emails being deleted from the trash. 1 minute clogging the operating system, gone forever the next. Picture the laborer walking away from the castle, standing a little taller, shoulders back, whistling a merry tune. If this were a musical, we might see him do a little jig,
tap his heels together in the air. But this is a lifelike story, and the laborer sees a fellow worker, one who owes him a piddling sum. So the laborer stops in his tracks. He lapses back into bondage to spreadsheets and accounts receivable and to a blind allegiance to what he sees as fair. Yo, you owe me $5. Pay up now, right now. The co-worker falls to his knees. Patience, man, patience. Friday's coming. I will get right with you. But no, that is not good enough. The man whose debt has been forgiven is hard. Immediately, he throws the man in prison. Really? Set free from an impossible debt? This man cannot look past the cost of a cup of coffee and a donut? Really? Your son is dying, and instead of celebrating that you get to spend another birthday with him, you want to chew him out? So often, our captivity is of our own making. So often, our captivity is to a self-righteous sense of fairness that is corrupted by pride and arrogance and reinforced by a self-inflicted blindness to grace. So often, our captivity is due to our refusal to accept the amazing freedom we are offered, the freedom to step beyond ourselves and into a realm that Christ opens to us, a realm where the unimportance of what trips us up is evident, and the great expanse of abundant life can be claimed. Accepting Christ's freedom, our ego needs dissolve before the joy of what we are given. God's forgiveness is freely offered us. See the parable. But gratitude is a learned trait that requires us to get outside ourselves. A toddler's perception that the world revolves around him is cute. Not so endearing is an adult's demand that the world center on him, his whims and insecurities. Gratitude requires recognition of another's grace-filled offering, of another's doing something for us, and our accepting the gift with humility. Taking a gift for granted or receiving a gift with a sense of entitlement makes waste of what is offered and deprives us of the wonder and awe of the connection that unites us through a gift given and received. Grace is like clear mountain air. Grace is a candle's light in darkness. Grace enfolds us in its warmth and gentleness. Grace lifts what weighs us down. Grace gives us freedom, the ability to breathe deeply, and it is a gift that is ours to share. Grace moves us beyond pettiness to acceptance of what we can never deserve, but can pass on. Grace always catches us by surprise. If grace were rote, it would be routine, and grace is never routine. Grace always exceeds expectations. Perhaps this is why the spurning of grace shocks and surprises us. Many years ago, before I went to seminary, I was helping out with my church's vacation Bible school. As an experiment, we set the schedule to run weeknights, one Monday through Friday, from 5:30 until 8:30, so that whole families could participate. Each evening began with a light supper. One day that week, just before time for the meal, I was in the pastor's office when a car, missing a muffler, drove up and rumbled to a stop in the parking lot. The car's windows were open. Stray heads and arms protruded, all of which added credence to the reality that the car was stuffed beyond capacity. The father of the large family soon presented himself at the door to the pastor's study. "Preacher," he said, "we ain't had nothing to eat for 3 days. There's 7 hungry kids in the back of my wagon, and we wondered if you wouldn't give us some money so we can get us some food." The preacher stepped across the room and extended his hand to the stranger. "Welcome to First Presbyterian Church," he said. "Your timing's good. We're having Bible school here this week, and you and your family are welcome to come in and join us for dinner." "What you serving?" the stranger asked. "Well, let me see," the minister said as he turned to look at the week's menu tacked to his corkboard. "This is Thursday, so tonight's hot dogs with all the fixings."
"Hot dogs? We don't want any old hot dogs."
The preacher looked surprised.
"Well, I'm sorry, sir, but that's what we're having here tonight."
The scruffy man turned on his heels with a harumph and stomped back to his car.
Friends, the root of gratitude is grace. Why is grace so hard to accept? True gratitude changes us. It leads to more than a word of thanks or, once upon a time, a note. True gratitude leads to action and opens us to Jesus's math lessons, lessons that strike terror in the hearts of those who like to keep score. Jesus's system of accountability sounds like chaos because his system allows an infinite number of do-overs. Jesus's system allows second and third and fourth and 40th and an infinite number of offerings of grace. That's another truth about grace. It is without limit. Of course it matters if we run up debts we cannot pay, if we fixate on perceived slights or take advantage of people. Of course we know that anything goes only works when accompanied by a Cole Porter soundtrack, that civilization depends on limiting our appetites and excesses and being respectful of one another. Do we know that life in community means showing one another the grace and forgiveness we are shown? Sonny and a bunch of his buddies had stopped by the local watering hole after work. Driving home a few hours later, he hadn't seen the kid on the bike, the kid who was dead before Sonny knew what he hit. The boy's family is one of those that gives us pause, one of those that causes us to marvel. The boy's family forgave Sonny, said they knew alcoholism is a disease. But the boy's family was surprised a couple years later when their younger son's errant baseball broke Sonny's kitchen window and he demanded payment for its repair. Really? Really? Do we stake claims on principle when blind self-centeredness is the actual cause of our rude or senseless actions? What blocks our acceptance of the freedom Jesus Christ offers us? Is ingratitude what causes us to walk on by, unmoved, unchanged? God's gift is for us. It is the gift of new life. Why would we choose to stay locked in narrow bitterness instead of stepping into the wide open freedom of forgiving and being forgiven? Make no mistake, God's forgiveness is not fair. It is grace. God's forgiveness is not tit for tat, a penny placed on a scale, a penny taken off the scale. God's grace is freedom to live large, not to be hung up on one another's shortcomings, but to rejoice in God's extravagant acceptance and share that extravagance with others. Thank God. God does not weigh what is fair and what is not. Thank God, God forgives beyond measure. And thank God, we have the freedom to do likewise. To God be all glory, honor, and praise, world without end. Amen.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Dr. Fairfax F. Fair, Senior Pastor of First Presbyterian Church of Ann Arbor, Michigan. For a free printed transcript of her message entitled, Choosing to be Captive or Free, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1. That's 888-411-DAY1. 3291. Or write to us at Day 1, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. And keep in mind that Day 1 depends on the financial contributions of our faithful listeners. If you appreciate our ministry, please consider sending a donation. We're grateful for your much-needed support. I'm Sherry Miller. Next week on Day 1, we're pleased to welcome the very Reverend Malcolm Clemens Young, Dean of Grace Episcopal Cathedral in San Francisco, California. His message is entitled, Gospel for the Superfluous. Be sure to be listening. Fairfax Fair offers some final reflections on today's message with our host, Peter Wallace.
Fairfax, in some ways, this parable of Jesus's is hard to believe. The fellow whose enormous debt is forgiven through the king's sheer grace turns around and forces another fellow who owes him a pittance to pay up. It's just ridiculous. Yet you shared several more recent examples of this same phenomenon. When we think about it carefully, we may just realize that we too can lapse back into this bondage, into a blind allegiance to what we think is fair. You said so often our captivity is of our own making. We are captive to a self-righteous sense of fairness, corrupted by pride and arrogance, and reinforced by a self-inflicted blindness to grace. Why do you think we have such a hard time with this? Is it sheer selfishness or fear of losing something?
Peter, I think some of it is our fear of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. We are so concerned for ourselves. We've been trained and conditioned to seek every advantage and to look out for ourselves above everything else. And so we've closed ourselves off to this amazing gift that is available to us through God's grace, through Jesus Christ. So much tension goes away if we will just allow ourselves to trust God and not think that at every moment we have to be up and out and thinking that our peace or our security is dependent on our being in front of someone else. There is enough grace for everyone if we can just relax a little bit and take a deep breath and realize that God has always our best interests at heart and wants abundant life for all of us.
God's forgiveness is freely offered us, as the parable tells us, but you said gratitude is a learned trait that requires us to get outside ourselves. Gratitude requires recognition of another's grace-filled offering and another's doing something for us and our accepting it with humility, you told us. So how do we learn this trait of gratitude?
A part of it is perhaps recognizing the sacrifice